does it better. Makes me feel sad for the rest. Nobody does it half as good as you.
Carol Bayer-Sager has been among the most admired and successful songwriters over the past 5 decades, responsible for the lyrics of some of the most popular songs of the 20th century, including Nobody Does It Better, Groovy Kind of Love, Don't Cry Out Loud, and the theme from the movie Arthur. In all, she has written over 400 songs. She's won an Oscar, 2 Golden Globes, and a Grammy for Song of the Year. And she's collaborated with everyone from Ray Charles and Bob Dylan to Frank Sinatra and Barbara Streisand. Now she's written a memoir from Simon & Schuster called They're Playing Our Song, which chronicles her relationship and work with Marvin Hamlisch and Burt Bacharach, to whom she was married for 10 years. I'm very pleased it has brought Carol Bayer-Sager to our show now. Hello.
Hi, it's nice to be here. Thank you.
And you've written hit songs for so many famous singers, Michael Jackson, Barbara Streisand, Celine Dion, Whitney Houston, Neil Diamond, Carly Simon, the list goes on and on. Did you write most of them with the performers in mind?
That's interesting. Sometimes yes, and sometimes no. When Marvin Hamlisch and I wrote the song you just played, Nobody Does It Better, we both heard Carly Simon, but after the song was written. So in that case, no, but immediately yes. And sometimes I wrote with artists who, artists, singer-songwriters, so I knew they would be recording the material first, as in Peter Allen and Melissa Manchester. So when Peter and I wrote a song, I knew it would end up on his album. And sometimes I recorded them on mine, and I think our albums served to be great demos for really great singers who'd mine our albums. One of mine, in case in point, was an album where I put a song called It's the Falling in Love that I wrote with the very talented David Foster. And Quincy Jones heard it and recorded it with Michael Jackson on his first of the trilogy of albums, Off the Wall. I think it was Off the Wall, Thriller, and Bad. It's like that sacred trilogy of Michael albums. But
well, when you hear Michael Jackson sing a song that you wrote with a very different kind of mindset, not thinking of him, do you learn something about your own song?
Yeah, I learned it sounds better. I learned it sounds a lot better when Michael sings it than me.
Playwrights will say, I wrote it, I heard a voice when I wrote that line, and then a great actor took it over, and I heard something totally different.
That you're right, Leonard. That often happens, and
sometimes the songwriters didn't like the
version. The song I'm thinking of that popped into my mind when you said that is David Foster and I wrote a song for a small animated movie that really just kind of crashed and burned at the box office called Quest for Camelot, and the girl in the animated character was going off on a dangerous adventure, and they wanted a song there. And I said, let's write a prayer for her mother to sing as she goes off. So we wrote a song called The Prayer. And it was recorded by Celine Dion and Andrea Bocelli. And I went into New York with David when he produced the vocals, Andrea's vocals on that record. And when I heard the finished record of Andrea and Celine doing The Prayer, I really thought, this is so much more beautiful and so much more touching than I even dreamed it would be. And I loved the song when we wrote it, but it took on a whole nother level when you have those kind of voices singing this very heartfelt little, what was a small prayer and got bigger and bigger. But
now you know how Puccini must have felt.
Exactly, exactly.
Now, Carly Simon's Nobody Does It Better wound up the James theme in a James Bond movie. Did you know that was going to happen?
Yes, because Marvin said he was going out to, he had to fly to London to score the Bond movies, The Spy Who Loved Me. And I said, oh, I'd love to write a Bond song. I have a title if I that just came into my mind. I said, you know, if I was writing that song, I'd call it Nobody Does It Better. And Marvin loved it so much, he raced to the piano and started to play the chorus of Nobody Does It Better. And I immediately wrote the rest of the lyric. So we had this chorus, and he had to, when he flew to London, he had to convince the producer of the film, Cubby Broccoli, that I was a suitable lyricist because I'd never written anything for a film. And so they were reluctant, but they loved that chorus, so they said, yes, let her write it. And I was in Los Angeles at the time, and Marvin was in London, and I just had a tape of the rest of the song, the melody. So I worked in my least favorite way, which was writing the lyric to the melody without him in the room. I love to write with someone else in the room so that I can say, what do you think? And, you know, you throw your inhibitions away and you just say whatever comes into your mind. And it's fine if they say that's awful, because then you just, but you get that immediate feedback of collaboration. But I was alone and I had to write it, and I did. And we both heard Carly on it, and Marvin flew to New York and played it for Carly. She loved it, and Richard Perry flew, I think, to New York to get her vocals on it. And then we all flew to London, not Carly, but Richard and I, when Marvin put the strings on. So it was a very, it was quite a worldwide collaboration, but it was, she was the perfect voice to sing that song.
Talk about collaboration. Because in the old days, of course, you would have written a song with Marvin Hamlisch. A song plugger would have taken it to some singer. They would have recorded it live with the backup musicians, and that would have been the end of it.
That's right.
And now the but songs,
you know,
are
what?
Put together like patchwork
but
quilts.
My life in songwriting never really worked that way. Only the very first hit I had was gotten by a song plugger who played it for a producer who recorded it with an English group called the Mindbenders, and my first hit was called A Groovy Kind of Love.
How old were you when you wrote
that? I was about 20. Mm-hmm. And it went to number one, and I thought, oh, this is so easy. But the fact is, all the songs that came after, I pretty much either got by calling someone or playing it, finding the producer myself, or as I started to have more and more hits, I was able to call the artist directly.
Did you grow up listening to this kind of
I did.
Stuff? You were,
I did. I loved
it. You grew up near the Brill Building, you say, so you actually had maybe proximity played a was a factor.
Well, it certainly helped. I mean, I think if I was writing in Des Moines, Iowa, at the same time, I wouldn't have had the access that I did being 10 blocks away from the Brill Building and Tin Pan Alley and 1650 Broadway. And at that time, I was 15 years old, so it was so unique at the time to have, I was writing with a girlfriend in high school, to be roaming the halls of the Brill Building, knocking on doors, that you made relationships. So even if you didn't get your song recorded, you knew you had a place to go back and play the next song.
What happened? You were teaching, just starting to teach when
well,
the song
Well, I was
hit.
Already writing songs, but I, my mother and father were very practical, and they said, how many people do you know who are hit songwriters? And I said, none. And they said, that's why we really think it's important that you teach. So I was teaching school in a vocational girls' school in New York City called Mapledean Bacon, and I would go down and call the charts at lunch hour, see if the song was, how it was doing, and Groovy Kind of Love became a hit while I was still teaching school, and it was amazing. I also saw an incredible inequity at the time, because I was teaching school for $5,200 a year, and I got a check in the mail for something like $34,000, and I went, oh my God, for something that I just love to do, and it took me no time, and here I'm punching a clock every day. And I really saw that in that moment, the inequity of what, you know, teaching is so important, educating our children, and what I did as I would have done for free, you know, to write that song.
But you got 7 years' pay with one check.
I know.
That led you to quit teaching?
It did, because I could now support myself full time and just devote all my time to writing.
My guest is Carol Bayer Sager. She's written a memoir called They're Playing Our Song. It is published by Simon and Schuster. You write that as a child you had the intense need to be seen and heard.
Well, I think I begin my book saying that if my mother had been a little less critical or a little more nurturing, maybe I wouldn't have had the intense desire to be seen and heard. But I believe that it is just that, that when I was very young, I had a ventriloquist act, and my dummy could say things for me that I couldn't say for myself. And that very easily seemed to, you know, move into lyrics where I could say things. I wasn't the artist, so I didn't have to take responsibility, but I could write in song some of my feelings.
And it's always been in collaboration. You've never written a melody?
I did once, and then I realized I had stolen a Paul Simon melody, so I went back to collaborating. But
well, at least steal from the good ones.
Always steal from the best, that's right. But I can write music, and I often, some of my favorite collaborations is where there's just no boundary. I can say, what about this, and play something, and they'll love it, and they'll say, well, why don't you say this, and that's my favorite way to write.
So it's not the old question, who writes the lyric? What comes first, the lyrics or the melody? You did it simultaneously?
That's my favorite way to write, simultaneously, give and take. I wrote that way with Peter Allen and Melissa Manchester and Marvin. And the only person I didn't write that way with was Burt Bacharach, who, maybe that's why he's one of the great, great songwriters of our time, because his melody, once he came up with it, was locked, and you had to fit your lyric to that melody.
Well, he had those quirky rhythms. It must have been
fantastic,
both fun and difficult.
Challenging, and I don't know how much fun. It was challenging because his rhythms were so unique, and you had to fit your words in and make them feel effortless. The best story I can tell you is when Bert and I were writing their That's What Friends Are For. And he played me the melody, and I said, oh, I love that. He played da 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 da. And I said, great, why don't we say, I never thought I'd feel this way. And he said, because that's not what I played. I played da 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 da. So I said, great, I never thought I'd feel this way. Carol, I'm playing da da, I need that 16th note. So I said, fine, then just say and. So he goes, and I never thought. And when I hear it still to this day on the radio, I go, gosh, Bert was right. And not only was he right that it sounds better to start with, and I never thought, he was right even in my rebelliousness of saying, just say and. It makes the lyric so much better because you're coming in the middle of a thought. So I give you that, Bert. You were completely right.
You are critical of him in other ways. We'll get to that after we take a little break. But your follow-up hit to A Groovy Kind of Love was Midnight Blue. written in partnership with a then little-known singer named Melissa Manchester.
Yes.
We're going to go to a break. Maybe we'll talk a bit about that and,
sure.
and your collaboration with Marvin Hamlisch and with Burt Bacharach, with
sure.
whom you were married 10 years.
Yes.
Whatever it is, it'll keep till the morning. Haven't we both got better things to do? Midnight blue. Even the simple things become rough. Haven't we had enough?
That's the theme from the movie Arthur, for which Carol Bayer Sager won an Oscar.
Actually, Leonard, it's not.
No.
I won an Oscar for Arthur's theme.
Oh.
And
oh,
this is the theme from
Night Shift. Oh, you won a Grammy for this one.
Yes,
I'm sorry.
I won Song of the Year with Burt.
Uh-huh. But this one, how many people did you collaborate on this one?
Just Burt and I wrote this, but the story behind this song is that we wrote it for a movie called Night Shift, which is a small cult movie. It was Michael Keaton's first movie. And Rod Stewart recorded it, and it wasn't a hit. They didn't release it as a single. And when Bird and Dion got reunited, he played her the song, and she loved it, and she said she wanted to sing it with Stevie Wonder. So she put her voice on, and then the night Stevie was coming to the studio, I told my girlfriend, Elizabeth Taylor, who, yes, it's that Elizabeth Taylor, and she was my girlfriend, that Stevie was going to put his voice on the record. And she said, oh, I've always wanted to meet him. So I said, come down to the studio with us. So Elizabeth came to the studio with me, albeit a little late, but because she always did everything a little late. And when Elizabeth was listening to Stevie sing, I looked at her, and it just occurred to me that this would be a wonderful song to give the proceeds to AMFAR, the American Foundation for AIDS Research, because Elizabeth was the first huge celebrity who came out and was brave enough to shine a light on AIDS and embrace its victims and you know, speak up and for them. And she was the co-founder at the time of AMFAR. So then Stevie finished his part, Gladys Knight and Elton John, and we raised a number of millions of dollars for AIDS research.
And Elizabeth Taylor introduced you to Michael Jackson. Is that
true? No,
oh.
That's not true. No.
Oh,
but say anything you want.
Okay.
No, I actually introduced Elizabeth to Michael Jackson.
Oh, well, okay.
And she became...
Oh, this is good. They became good friends.
She became very good friends with him.
Well, let's jump back a little bit. In the 70s, you were introduced to Marvin Hamlisch. I got that one right?
Yes, you got it perfectly right.
And you write that you are an improbable pair.
Well, we were from day one. I mean, he liked to dress in a suit and a tie. And as you can see, I'm still wearing my jeans and maybe a little more grown up, a nice jacket. But, you know, he was very New York, very buttoned down, very much concentrating on Broadway. He'd had enormous success with A Chorus Line and won a Pulitzer Prize. And I was this pop songwriter from L.A. at that point, not fully, but living more in L.A., coming back and forth. And when our relationship kind of moved from friendship to a romantic relationship, we lived together in L.A., and he was always envious of the pop songs I was writing. And I would say, but you're Marvin Hamlisch. You won 3 Oscars in one night. You wrote a chorus line. So he saw himself as this kind of stately older man. We were actually the same age. And he saw me as this young pop, I don't know what he thought, but it was a strange relationship because together we were like jumping beans. I mean, his energy plus my energy, both New York energy, even in L.A., you know, we were just talking over each other and writing so quickly. And
is it good to be romantically involved with somebody you're collaborating on music with? On songs
looking with? Back between Marvin and then a 10-year marriage to Bert, I would say no.
Even though a lot of great songs came out.
Well, I'm grateful for the great songs. I'm even more grateful for Bob Burt's and my son, Christopher Bachrach. But it's an enormous amount of time spent with one person. You spend the time writing, then you go to the studio and make the demo, then you write some more, then you produce, then you're supposed to go into the house and be this happily married couple. But Bert was obsessive with his music, and we'd be at home at 8 o'clock at night. I'm ready to watch my favorite television show, and he'd say, "Hey," and he spoke in the rhythms in which he wrote, "Hey, Kat, you want to come over to the music room with me? I just want to have this thing in my head. I want to just play it for you now, Bert." at 8 o'clock, I mean, we are done. We worked all day, you know. So it was a lot.
And you're right. The only thing Bert was able to commit to was Bert. So that was another kind of a problem?
Well, you know, Bert told me, you know, Maya Angelou said, when someone shows you who they are, believe them. Bert told me and showed me who he was very early on. I went into illusion because thought I was very much in love with him. And it's not that Bert ever meant to hurt anyone, I don't believe, in his life. It's just that Bert's music came first. That really was his number one thing in his life. Then came his family, his wife, his children, his horses were in there, his working out was in there, he had an awful lot of things he needed to do, so that by the time he got to you, there wasn't all that much Bert to go around. And he said to me once, "Hey, babe, I'm a selfish guy," you know, and maybe that kind of genius comes with that kind of persona. Look, we're great friends today. He's been a wonderful father to Christopher, our son. I visited him just last week because he wasn't feeling too well. And, once I healed, and actually he did me the greatest favor of my life, because I then finally found there was a man who came into my life who was a real adult, and his name was Bob Daly. We're still married. It's 25 years later, and what he said he meant, and what he did, he was an executive, something that I would have run from in the past, and he finally made me feel safe, which is something I never felt in my life, not in my childhood and not in my early years, as even songwriting.
A science writer once told me that the third major relationship is always the best, because the first time you blame the other person, the second time you realize that you played as much of a role in the problems as
I do
as
realize
the spouse
that.
Did.
That's true. I realize with Bert I was responsible for a lot of what went on.
Let's talk about the title of your book, The Playing Our Song. It's also the name of a play based on...
A musical based... Well, Neil Simon looked at Marvin's and my relationship. They were working together on trying to make The Gingerbread Lady into a musical. And Marvin would come in and say, oh, I'm living with this girl. She's so crazy. She this, she that. And Neil got more interested in the relationship between this neurotic Jewish male Marvin Hamlisch and this crazy young kind of wacky girl that he was living with. And he asked Marvin, could he take me to lunch? And we went to lunch and he said, you know, I'm thinking about ditching Gingerbread Lady and writing a musical about the two of you. How would you feel about that? And I said, great. And actually, Marvin and I were about to split up then, but we were friends when we met and we went back to a friendship and had a great time writing the show.
It's kind of odd that you have good friendships with all the people you've split up with.
Well, you know, I have a girlfriend who said something wonderful to me once, and I've lived with it and believe it. Relationships never have to change if you will, never have to end if you allow the form to change.
I'm speaking to Carol Bayer-Sager, who's written a memoir called They're Playing Our Song. How did you meet Peter Allen?
We were fixed up by a publisher at Metro Media at the time, and I instantly loved him, and I think we connected immediately.
Did it help the fact that he was just a friend and a collaborator?
Well, he was gay, which made it completely a friend. And I think, yes, I think it helped in so many ways, his whole sense of, but he was one of a kind, Peter. He left us way too soon. His sensibility was fantastic. He lived every moment of his life with a champagne glass in one hand and, you know, a song in the other. It's great.
Now, you've also recorded.
I have.
Going all the way back to 1977.
Yes.
Now, some of the other songwriters in a similar situation, like Carole King, became famous as singers as well. Has it been okay for you to have a respectable career as a performer, but really be best known
as a
lyricist?
Yeah. I mean, I actually never thought I was much of a singer. I'm still not. I just think that it's always interesting when you hear the songwriter sing the songs they wrote.
Well, you did the demos.
Sometimes. But I think I would never dream of singing a song I didn't write. I mean, I'm not a singer classically. Mm-hmm. I just interpret my own songs.
Bob Dylan, someone who rarely collaborates with other songwriters, reach out to you to co-write a song?
That was amazing.
Are you going to get a piece of the Nobel Prize?
I don't think I'm even going to get a scintilla of the Nobel Prize, which he richly deserves. But it's a very funny chapter in my book, if one of you out there wants to read it. It was the worst collaboration, but brilliantly funny and enjoyable, because I kept looking across and saying, I'm writing with Bob Dylan, you know.
Now, it didn't become a hit, but was it a complicated collaboration?
Well, because as you might imagine, he is the most self-contained artist, and he's not a collaborative person by nature. So it felt like, I don't know, back in grade school, if you wanted to copy off of a friend's test and they covered their paper because they really weren't your friend and didn't, I mean... That was what it was like writing with Bob. I mean, we sat across from each other on two beds on either side of a big barn. So already there was like so much space between us. It was like unnatural to me. And I would give him lines and he'd say, yeah. And then he'd sing it back and he wouldn't have the line I gave him. He'd change it to something else. And so I don't know how many of my lines ended up on the floor. Maybe only about 10 of them ended up in the whole song. And I felt weird about it. I said, Bob, I don't think I can take half credit for this song. You threw out half of what I wrote. And he said, well, I wouldn't have written it if you weren't here. Mm-hmm. You know, I said, yeah, but he said, okay, I'll take two-thirds. I'll take two-thirds, you take a third. I said, okay, that sounds fair. But, you know, it was such an unlikely collaboration. We wrote a song called Under Your Spell, which is pretty good. I mean, pretty good. He wrote most of it. I loved the last line. I read in the book, I loved the last line. I hope that I don't die of thirst reaching for the well. And I said, I loved that last line. I wish I wrote it.
It must have been odd writing a song with somebody who's famous for his lyrics. But is that the only time that ever happened with you?
With another really great lyricist?
Let me
not call myself great, but with a great lyricist.
You're okay, Carol.
I've collaborated with Carole King, who sometimes writes her own lyrics, and Carly Simon, who sometimes writes her own lyrics. But they both have been known to write with other people who write lyrics. So no one as completely singular as Mr. Dylan.
Hmm. Are there younger artists that you'd like to work with?
Well, I just wrote a song that's actually number 12 this week, 8 this week on the dance charts, for a young artist named Jessica Sanchez, and it's called Stronger Together, and it happens to be the campaign song for Hillary Clinton and the DNC, and they played it all through the convention, and we'll see. I liked writing again.
There was a John Oliver bit where he had a whole bunch of singers, singer-songwriters, sing a song called Stop Using Our Song because politicians use songs without permission.
I don't know who your audience is, but I know every songwriter I know where Donald Trump has used their song, they've threatened to sue because they haven't given permission for that song to be used. And I actually not only gave permission, I wrote it for her with Babyface, a great talent, Kenny Babyface Edmonds, and Bruce Roberts, who's very active in the Democratic election this year. And, you know.
Well, it sounds to me like you've written a lot of songs knowing that they were going to serve a purpose, whether they were in a movie or, in this case, a political campaign.
That would be my preference, if I always knew where my little song was headed, you know. You don't always know, and I think I started to write less and less when more and more songs were, you know, making it into my trunk under my piano bench and not making it onto the charts.
Well, that's because movies aren't what they used to be.
Do you write any movies?
Do you write any songs about car crashes?
Yeah, big explosions. Blow it up.
You began painting not that long ago.
I did. I began painting for the last 6 years until I started writing the book, and I had 3 art shows, and turned out that I could paint sort of a little good. And, you know, I'll be interested in what I choose to do when I finish promoting They're Playing Our Song, the book, not the show, whether I'll want to write songs again or paint or write another book. I liked the process of writing a book. It was a lot about rewriting, more than I ever dreamed, but I liked the process. I thought of it as a very long song without music.
Do you think that the fact that you've written so many songs makes it easier just to sit down and start writing? Because the biggest problem for a beginning writer is just keeping that thing going.
Well, I had the discipline to write all the time, but I thought the book was written after about 6.5 months. I gave it to my agent, Binky Urban, and she said, well, there's a couple of great chapters here, but beyond that, you don't have a book, Carol. I said, I don't. She said, no, you have to go back. You have to dig much deeper. You have to get into those places, and you have to put context in, and we need to know this and this. And eventually, like a year and a half later, she said, now you have a book. And she gave it to one publisher to read over the weekend. She didn't put it out to a lot of people. That was Jonathan Karp at Simon & Schuster. And he had seen They're Playing Our Song, the musical, when he was a young man, very young, and fell in love with it. And when he read my book, he not only loved it, but I got doubly blessed because he said he wanted to be my editor. So my book is edited by the publisher of Simon & Schuster, and he's an extraordinary man. So I feel very blessed. I hope people will read it. It's the thing that one of the reasons I wrote it was not so much to write about all these songs, though they have been my life, but because I lived my life for so many years in fear and with so much anxiety, and I wanted people to understand that they should never compare their insides to someone else's outsides, because nobody knows when they look at you. They only see the facade that you want them to see, but they have no idea of the fear or terror or you know, just complete... I wasn't even present in so much of my own life, not until much later, not until I met Bob in my 40s, did I really was able to live in my own skin. And that's because he made me feel safe.
Carol Bayer-Sager will be speaking and signing books this Wednesday at 6:30 at the Long Island Lit Fest at the Madison Theater in Molly College. For tickets and directions, you can find a link on our show page at wmyc.org/lopate. Then on Thursday, she'll be at Shakespeare & Company at 7 o'clock. That's at Lexington Avenue between 68th and 69th Streets. We're going to go out with Arthur's theme.
Good.
Best That You Can Do, sung by Christopher Cross. The book from Simon & Schuster is They're Playing Our Song. Thank you so much, Carol Bayer-Sager, for being on our show.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Once in your life, you find her, someone who turns.